Hello and welcome
Okay.
to another episode of History Hack. We're thrilled today to welcome Maddie Pelling, who is a fellow at the John Rylands Research Institute and a specialist in early modern art and history. Hi, Maddie.
Hi, nice to be here.
How is lockdown? Are you bored yet?
You know, it's okay. Yeah, so I'm in Staffordshire. I moved in with my parents just before lockdown for a short-term job near Manchester, thinking I would be here for 3 months, and I'm still here, so
yeah.
A bit of a shock.
Oh, but at least there's no rent and scary things to take care of.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a little bit of rent, but, you know, they've accepted two cats and a dog along with me, so not too bad.
Excellent. Okay, we're going to talk to you today about the Duchess of Portland, who was a collector, and she had this museum, basically, to tell our listeners what we're here for. And it was quite a special collection. And following her death, it's sort of been sold off. But Maddie, you're here to talk to us about what's happened to it and trying to recreate it. So start us off by telling us, who was the Duchess of Portland?
Okay, so the Duchess of Portland is someone who many people won't have heard of. And yet really her work and her legacy remain in many ways at the heart of our culture in Britain and the stories that we continue to tell ourselves about who we are and where we came from. So to give her full title, Margaret Cavendish Bentinck, the second Duchess of Portland, was born in 1715 and she lived until 1785. So she's this incredibly important figure in 18th century life who, for various reasons, has been virtually forgotten today. So she was the daughter of a famous collector, Edward Harley, who he had a collection of ancient and medieval manuscripts, which formed the basis of what we now know to be the British Library. So she was also the mother of the third Duke of Portland, who served twice as the British Prime Minister. And she's actually the great, 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 I forget how many greats, grandmother of our current Queen, Elizabeth II. So she's really sort of invested in the institutions of our country. But what's most important for us, and I think most interesting, you know, in thinking about her, aside from her famous male relatives, is that she was part of this intellectual group of men and women who were known at the time in the 18th century as the Blue Stockings. So this is a bunch of people who came together in salons across London and more provincial towns and private houses across the country where they would discuss, you know, literature, art, science and other sort of pressing issues of the day. And the Duchess was really at the heart of the cultural conversations that were taking place in these spaces, and as part of her contribution to this world of sort of intellectual experiment, she collected this vast private museum, which became known by the 1780s as the Portland Museum. And it was this sort of bigger, better version of the collection that her father had made and which she'd grown up with as a child. And it contained, amongst other things, thousands of natural history specimens, so plants, shells from all over the world, but also things like Roman antiquities, Renaissance art. And it became this important extension of the Blue Stocking salons, where, as I think we're going to, you know, go on to talk about, people came from all over to look at and actually to publish work on the curiosities that she'd assembled. And Alex, as you rightly say, the really interesting part of her story is that following her death in 1785, her museum's actually sold off to the public, and so it's essentially destroyed. But with a little bit of detective work, we can actually find that, you know, many of the treasures in her museum have made their way eventually into our national collections. So if you go today to, for example, the Natural History Museum or the British Museum, you'll see objects on display there that were in her collection. And so her work is hidden in plain sight, basically. And although she has been, you know, sort of discounted from canonical history, parts of her collection are still sort of being used to tell the stories about our past and how we perceive our place in the world on a sort of national level.
So let's go back and sort of right this wrong then. First, put her in context with her collecting. Why is collecting a big deal in the 18th century?
Okay, so collecting objects that are interesting or important in some way has it's been around for, you know, much of human history. But it's really in the early modern period that the cabinet of curiosity takes off. So this is something that has its roots in the medieval world, where people would gather and display religious relics, you know, so the bones of saints, the foreskin of Jesus, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And from the 16th and 17th centuries onwards, it also starts to reflect the fact that Europeans are increasingly able to travel, to trade with, and, you know, it's very important to note, to colonize non-European lands and communities. And it's these early versions of museums that are really interesting in showing off objects from these early encounters. And they sort of pick objects that are unique and make people feel, you know, wonder or fear or excitement. So you might expect to see things like a huge fossil or some unusual looking weaponry, or my personal favourite, a stuffed crocodile.
Yeah, they love stuffing things, don't they, at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You get a lot of sort of taxidermied animals that, you know, aren't native to Britain, and these sort of these wacky curiosities. So by the 18th century, when the Duchess of Portland is collecting, people start to become less interested in what is unique or and what is sort of wonderful, and instead they become interested in types of things. So how objects in nature and, you know, some man-made artifacts can be categorized and understood. So this is taking place within the period that becomes known as the Enlightenment. And of course, you know, this is quite a loaded term. So simply put, it's the idea that within 18th century Europe in particular, rational thinking and the development of science and literature sort of leads the world out of this supposed dark age of superstition, you know, folklore, belief in magic. But of course, this can and, you know, should be contested. It obviously discounts many other cultures, ways of thinking and knowing, but essentially this is a time when philosophers, writers and scientists set about bringing what many saw as order to the world around them, and collecting and categorizing objects sort of becomes one way that this can be done, and this is what happens in the Duchess of Portland's museum.
As ever, men get a bit arsy when women try and get in on the action, don't they? Why is there this anxiety around women collecting?
Okay, so there is an anxiety, definitely, and this is something that we see in the sort of the early histories that are written of the Duchess of Portland and her collecting. So in the 20th century, a lot of sort of biographers or people interested in the history of her family will always mention her in, you know, sort of passing remarks, and they talk about her as though she's like a crazy hoarder. So it's the idea of, you know, they call her manic, and that she had this sort of unstoppable, you know, unquenchable thirst to acquire things, and that she didn't really understand what she was doing.
Like an uncontrollable female, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, someone who just can't stop shopping, basically. Ugh, you can't stop buying things. Yeah, exactly. And this is actually an insult that's kind of leveled at her in the 18th century by some of her contemporaries. So people like Horace Walpole, who was another very famous collector, you know, he described some of her museum when it's auctioned off at the end of her life. And he sort of, he goes along to the auction and sort of sneers at what's on display, and, you know, says she had no taste and she didn't know what she was doing. She just couldn't help herself, you know. And so really my work's interested in sort of, you know, rewinding that narrative a little bit and thinking about the choices that she made in her collecting, you know, what kind of objects she went after and what kind of story she was trying to tell.
And putting Walpole in his place as well.
Absolutely.
So how can we reconstruct a museum that no longer exists? But let's talk about, what did it look like when it was hers? How did she display it? Who got to visit? And what would they see?
Okay, so this is sort of a really central question. So how do you go about researching a collection that doesn't exist anymore? So as I've said, you know, you can trace some individual objects, but the nature of a collection means that artifacts really have been gathered together in a very specific way to give them meaning or to tell a story. So when that is disrupted and a collection is destroyed, as the Duchess of Portland's was, how can we know anything about what the original collector intended? So as I've said, my research is kind of interested in uncovering these sort of original messages that the museum held. So why did the Duchess acquire, for example, a particular shell? From whom did she acquire it? And what did it mean to display it next to something like, for example, an ancient Egyptian figurine or, you know, a Native American axe head? So the Duchess's life, during the Duchess's life, the museum is stored across two sites. So it's at her country house at Bulstrode Park in Buckinghamshire, and her townhouse in Privy Gardens, Whitehall in London, which sadly neither building exists anymore. But I believe the house in Privy Gardens is actually pretty much where the Ministry of Defence is today.
Okay.
So, you know, going and walking that area. So the starting point in recovering something of what the museum looked like is the sale catalogue that was printed as part of the 1786 auction that happened after she died when the museum was sold off. And of course, this isn't a complete record of everything she had, but it gives an idea of some of the things in the museum. So if I may, I'm just going to read out some of the really brief catalogue descriptions. So
absolutely.
As well as like, you know, like I said, the thousands of shells from all over the world, birds' nests, crystals and fossils, there were some of these items. So there's a curious feather ornament from New Zealand, a lady's headdress, an elegant silk screen from China, two wampum belts of the Indians of North America, a hard stone with an inscription in the runic character, a specimen of the hair of Mary, Queen of France, and a miniature portrait of Sir Walter Raleigh. So this is kind of like crazy mixture of historic, you know, sort of ethnographic objects going on here. But the museum wasn't just an indoor space. So, you know, when we go to a museum today, we expect to see things in glass cases, it's all quite static. But actually at Bulstrode, so her country estate in Buckinghamshire, the museum sort of extended outside. So there were hundreds of peacocks. These are all living animals. So there was peacocks, there was some Indian bison, and there was even a zebra. And I actually found a really bizarre reference in a letter which mentions that the zebra dies in a tragic accident, and that's all I know about it, and I'm so desperate to know what happened.
Oh, no. That's like the parrot at Andrew Jackson's funeral. No one recorded what the parrot said. It's like unbearable. Yeah. Apparently it offended everybody and people shocked.
Excellent.
And no one knows what it said. But yeah, that must be really irritating.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. But, you know, these sort of brief glimpses, they give us, you know, a window onto this array of, you know, really sort of colourful, historic and exotic objects. But actually, this is an assembly that, you know, it's bringing different things together, but it's doing something really important in that it's gathering artefacts from British and European history. So things like the portrait miniature of Sir Walter Raleigh or the hair of Mary, Queen of France. And it's placing them alongside things found, traded, you know, or stolen from Indigenous communities in places like North America and New Zealand. And there's also items in there from, you know, Hawaii, Lapland, many other places. In order to really form a picture or a narrative of Britain's place in the world as understood by these white aristocratic people who are doing the collecting. So it's essentially an investment in the colonial stories that obviously go on to shape the 19th century and beyond and are still having a tangible impact in the world. You know, but it's a kind of, it's a knowledge-making process that is interested in the past, but also in placing the people doing the collecting at what was seen as the forefront of some geographical exploration, but also intellectual experiment, really.
So she didn't open it to the public. So who got to go and see these things and why would they go?
Yeah, so the museum was invitation only. So in the 18th century, public museums really start to appear in some form from sort of the 1750s. So you get the founding of the British Museum then, which is made up of the collection of Sir Hans Sloane, who's a contemporary, slightly earlier collector of the Duchess. So the Duchess's Museum is private and it sustains this really broad private community of people who are friends with the Duchess and who might be interested in, you know, bringing her gifts, gaining her patronage, but also using the collection in its own right for scientific research or artistic inspiration. So George III and Queen Charlotte are regular visitors, as well as Elizabeth Montagu, who at the time is known as the Queen of the Blue Stockings. So, you know, the sort of the social circle that the Duchess was part of. And she's one of the Duchess's oldest friends. So the shell and plant collections that the Duchess gathered drew naturalists as well, like Joseph Banks, who'd accompanied Captain Cook on his voyage to Tahiti in New Zealand. And my personal favourite is the French botanist and philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So Rousseau is a really interesting case. So he famously said that women weren't really intellectually capable of doing science, and that the Duchess was... you know, not necessarily up to his intellectual standards, but when he meets her, he has to admit that she's actually really knowledgeable. And he's sort of so surprised by this. And I just love that anecdote, but I think it, oh, you know, obviously reflects more on him.
Yeah, absolutely.
On her abilities. So, I mean, actually the Duchess's Museum is this really important place for learned women. And there's, you know, real opportunity here for women that aren't necessarily in other institutions in the 18th century. So in the 1740s, for example, the Duchess employs the famous Anglo-Saxon scholar Elizabeth Elstob to live at Bulstrode and to teach her children. But more than this, the museum's a sort of experimental environment. So like I say, it's not just objects that are inside glass cases, but it's always buzzing with activity. So, you know, if you visited, you might expect to see visitors and servants in the corner, sort of drying and pressing flowers or sketching shells, writing out catalogues of objects, or the paintings on the walls was very popular. And also, you know, essays, people would write essays on the historical objects in the collection. So there's an example that I really love of Mary Hamilton, who was a friend of the Duchess, and she'd served at the court of George III in the royal nursery, looking after his children. They called her Hammy. And she comes to the museum and she writes an essay on the earring that's supposedly worn by Charles I when he has his head chopped off. And this was an object that was, you know, a favourite of the Duchess of Portland. She would bring it out to show people, and it kind of transported people to that really important historic moment. So this is a really exciting place to be, and it's one where men and women could learn as well as socialise. And actually those two aspects are kind of blurred together. So there's a fantastic description by another of the Duchess's friends, Mary Delaney, who is a famous letter writer and artist in her own right. And she talks about the drawing room at Bulstrode being so full of sieves, which are being used to, you know, clean the specimens. And the tables and chairs are so covered in paper and scissors and sort of the other apparatus of the museum, that anyone visiting will struggle to find a seat. I think that sort of sums up the environment.
You know. She's hugely influential, therefore, in books that are written at the time, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. So she's the patron of several scientists, sort of naturalists, early botanists, who she gives money to go on expeditions around the UK. And it's important to note that she actually never travels beyond Britain herself, which is really fascinating, you know, considering that she's gathering this museum that's coming.
That's mad, and she never had the urge to go herself.
Yeah, so this is something that sort of is quite intriguing, really. So she regularly goes down to the south coast around Weymouth and collects shells from the beach there. But beyond that, she doesn't really travel. So she sort of gets, I mean, obviously she has enough money and enough status within 18th century elite culture to send people off to the ends of the earth and to, you know, make these connections. So essentially to, you know, to send people to get things for her.
I just think the compulsion for me would be to want to go and find them myself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose an important thing to remember is that she is a woman. And whilst she, for most of her career as a collector, she's actually a widow and therefore, you know, financially independent, obviously incredibly wealthy, she is still a woman, and there is this hostility that we've already spoken about, you know, about women who are collectors and their anxiety around that and the fact that they're not taken seriously. And so travel to some of the areas that she's interested in, so, you know, she's collecting objects from places like New Zealand and Hawaii, it just wasn't, travel to those places wasn't available for women of her status at this time.
She must have been constantly badgering people to bring her stuff then?
Yeah, absolutely. So she really sort of sets up a network of different people from lots of different walks of life, really, who can sort of source materials for her. So one of the sort of most regular ways that she does this is by asking her friends to write to their, you know, fathers, brothers, sons, whatever, who are in the Navy, or more commonly in the East India Company, and ask them to bring, you know, exotic shells and feathers back from their travels. So there's this amazing letter that's written in 1738 by the Duchess's friend Elizabeth Montagu, who you've already mentioned, and she was known, you know, as the Queen of the Blue Stockings, this intellectual circle the Duchess is part of. And she writes to her brother Robert, who at the time is out in Bengal working for the East India Company. And she asked him to collect some shells for the Duchess. And this is an amazing example in showing not just the global reach of the museum, but also the difficulties and the dangers, actually, in transporting messages and objects across the world. So the letter is sent by Elizabeth Montagu via an East India ship, the Grafton, that's heading to Bengal. Only when it reaches its destination, there's this huge cyclone that makes its way up the coast and up the Ganges. And this kills thousands of Indians, as well as the British and Dutch colonists who are there. And the Grafton's actually wrecked, you know, sending the letter to the bottom of the river in the Ganges. So we know about this because when Elizabeth Montagu finds out that her brother never received this message, she writes to the Duchess and, you know, she sort of says, oh, well, never mind. My brother's off to China next, so maybe he can get you something there. And this really gives, you know, a good idea of their worldview and how removed these elite women are from the realities of empire, you know, in which indigenous people in Bengal, who in this case, you know, have died in their thousands in an event that Montagu really sees as a bit of an inconvenience to her collecting.
Yeah.
you know, also places like Tahiti, New Zealand, North America, and these indigenous people sort of become these distant figures who are represented in the museum but don't have any sort of tangible sort of realistic presence.
I was gonna say, tell us about how that plays out with Captain Cook.
Yeah, okay, so Cook is sort of a friend and associate of the Duchess, and on his three Endeavour voyages, he also takes Joseph Banks, who is a sort of mutual friend between Cook and the Duchess, and he is the sort of leading naturalist of the day. And when Cook and Banks return to England after, I believe it's the second voyage, so they return in, I think, 1775, off the top of my head, Banks invites the Duchess to his townhouse in London with some friends, and she gets sort of first dibs on objects that have been brought back. And amongst the objects is at least one feathered cape that's supposedly worn by the sort of high-ranking members of society that they encounter in Hawaii. And of course, on the last and final voyage of Cook, he's actually killed in Hawaii. And in the sort of popular imagery of the day, these feathered capes become a sort of symbol of like frightening savagery and this sort of really violent murder of Cook. And so the fact that the Duchess has one of these actual artifacts in her museum, you know, and she sort of puts it on display as a symbol of the British Empire and this way of representing people who are not European and who are not part of her social circle as sort of intrinsically other. So, you know, this is a sort of inherently racist way of collecting, really, and it's a sort of system that's invested in the sort of structures of empire. So another really interesting example of how she sort of tells these stories of different parts of the world is in a box that she keeps as part of the museum. So this is just a wooden box that's lined with paper, and it survives in the Harley collection in Nottinghamshire now. And I'm very grateful to their wonderful curator, Sophie Littlewood, for drawing my attention to it. But it's a box filled with a range of objects that sort of represent the story that the Duchess is trying to tell about the world, you know, the history of civilization, of knowledge, of exploration, of all the things that she's interested in. So inside is a Native American stone axe head, a figurine carved from a shell in the Bahamas, a tiny ancient Egyptian statue and an eagle stone, which is basically what it says on the tin. You know, it's a stone that forms inside an eagle, a bit like a gallstone, I think. And so she would get this box out for visitors, and she'd go through this whole performance of taking out each object. But what's really interesting is she writes out these little labels that she attaches to each one, and they're basically like fake histories of each object. So histories are intended, you know, to reflect her ideas of the world, and not necessarily the original context of the objects themselves. So for the figurine that's made from a shell, she writes how this was found on an island near Exuma. It's supposed to have been left there by the Indians and made of the shell of a conch. Now, the island of Exuma in the Bahamas was originally occupied by the Lycaon people. So these are the Indians that the Duchess mistakenly refers to. Before the arrival of European colonizers, actually in the 17th century. So they're not even in this part of the world at this point. And so she presents them as like these, you know, sort of distant, passive, barely legible figures. And instead she emphasizes the moment of, you know, this figurine's discovery as central to its story. And it's told from the perspective of, you know, a European finder of this object. So you start to see how in the museum, indigenous people from all over the world are sort of represented as mysterious and even frightening for the entertainment of the Duchess and her friends.
It's mad. I love her. So if you had to pick one item in the museum, in her collection, what's the most famous or the most important thing she owned?
Okay, so, I mean, as I've said, there were lots of objects that excited the Duchess and her friends. So the feathered cape that Captain Cook brought back, or some of the weirder giant shells. But the object that remains sort of the most famous today is the Portland vase. So this is a Roman vase that was discovered in the tomb of a Roman emperor, Alexander Severus, outside Rome, and it's thought to have contained the ashes of his mother. And it's brought back to Britain by the famous antiquary Sir William Hamilton, who was involved in some of the early excavations around Pompeii, which I think you mentioned briefly in an earlier podcast. Mm-hmm. So by the time he gets to Britain, he's in a lot of debt because basically, a bit like the Duchess, he can't help himself when it comes to buying antiquities, although interestingly no one's criticizing him for this.
Yeah.
So he sees the vase in a showroom of the Scottish antiquities dealer James Byatt in Rome, and he basically says in a letter to a friend, you know, I saw it and I just thought I'll pay any price for it, I need that. But quickly realizes that that was a mistake and he can't afford it, so he brings it to Britain. And he goes around all the museums and the private gentlemen's clubs, so things like the Society of Antiquaries, publicly claiming credit for having saved this amazing artifact for the nation. But on the sly, he's looking to sell it to someone because he can't actually afford it. So the Duchess buys it in January of 1784, and she does it in secret, basically because she wants to go along with this sort of narrative that Sir William Hamilton's setting up, and she doesn't want to expose how much debt he's in. And actually, she only owns it for a year and then dies when it's put up for sale in the auction. And so it becomes this really important object once it is sort of arrives onto a public market at the auction, and it's a sort of free-for-all of people bidding for it. And it eventually makes its way to the British Museum, where it's still on display today. Although, interestingly, when you go, the display text underneath says that it was owned by the Dukes of Portland and says absolutely nothing about the Duchess. So, you know, that's something maybe to remedy. But, you know, it's this object that she basically saves for the nation. So it's once it's gone into the British Museum, its reproductions of it start to be sold by the potter Josiah Wedgwood. And in fact, you can still buy copies of it from the Wedgwood factory, and it's, you know, it's sort of recognizable the world over as this really famous artifact, and yet her name, you know, it's still known as the Portland vase, and yet no one is sort of aware of that connection with her. So that's, I just think it's a lovely way into thinking about her collecting and how we might sort of recover her legacy.
Absolutely. I mean, so it was lost in a sense. Tell us about the auction.
Okay, so this is just my favourite part of her story. So she dies in the summer of 1785, and there's this initial sort of panic that no one can find her will, but eventually when they do, they find that she wants to sell the auction to give the money to all of her children. although why they would need this when their mother's a duchess is, you know, debatable. So the museum is sold in this really epic 38-day auction, which begins in the spring of 1786. And it's really a turning point in the way the public, you know, who haven't really had access to the Duchess or her museum until now, how they see the collection, which is completely dismantled. So it's all moved from Bulstrode to her house in Whitehall, and suddenly available to anyone who can afford to bid on it. So it's a real shift in how it's being experienced. So what's really interesting is that none of the Duchess's friends, you know, who have up to this point worked in her museum, found objects for her, published work based on those objects, none of them attend. And so the story of the museum as this intellectual hub for a community of scholars, you know, artists, scientists, etc., is suddenly rewritten as the collection passes over into the sort of public domain. So the sale catalogue that we mentioned earlier is released in the days before the auction starts, and it's sold all over London. And it doubles as an admission ticket and becomes this kind of like collectible item. So for example, people could buy portraits of the Duchess and images of some of the items for sale, including the Portland bars, which, you know, they'd cut out and paste into the pages. So it becomes a sort of a souvenir, really. And the sale itself is already being made into a famous event. Mm. And the sale's overseen by an auctioneer called Thomas Skinner, who's a contemporary of James Christie, obviously, you know, of Christie's auction house fame. And I think it's really useful to think about the sale as being very much like a sort of glamorous and exciting Christie's auction today. So there's lots of tension, lots of drama, and lots of high-end luxury goods being bought and sold. So when the Portland auction does start, crowds are flocking to her house, the Duchess's house, in Whitehall, where it's being held, and it quickly becomes, you know, a fashionable place to be seen. And the newspapers start to dedicate inches to the gossip about which celebrity has appeared there that day, you know, whose mistress has bid on what, and which sort of rich collectors have been battling each other in bidding wars, and what they're paying for each treasure. So to give you an idea of the atmosphere, I've got a really short extract here from a newspaper called the Morning Chronicle. So I'll just read this really quickly. It's a couple of sentences. So it says, "The number of people that attended the Duchess of Portland's museum on Saturday last is scarce to be believed. The rooms were at once so exceedingly hot and crowded that several ladies fainted. The sale begins this day, and in what room the auctioneer is to exhibit, our correspondent knows not, but is satisfied that the largest room in the house is too small to contain half the persons who would wish to attend." So now what's really interesting is that reporters start to see the auction as this opportunity to write sort of tabloid style celebrity gossip. So another newspaper, the Morning Herald, produces this thing that it calls a list of supposed purchases. And it's basically like fake news. So it's a list of celebrities along with the objects they're meant to have bought, and which actually stand in for, you know, as a euphemism alluding to various sex scandals that they're involved in. So, I know, I love it. So, for example, there are reports about Seymour Fleming, Lady Worsley. So she has eloped with Captain George Bizet of the Southampton Militia. And she's been in this sort of shocking public court proceeding opposite her husband, Sir Richard Worsley, for the months leading up to this. And the Morning Herald suggests that at the Portland, auction that she buys, you know, suggestively named shells. So things like an orange wide-mouthed cone. So interpret that as you will. And at the same day's sale, there's another lady called Lady Anne Foley, who was the subject of, you know, a similarly public adultery trial. And she supposedly buys a thorny woodcock from the Duchess's shell cabinet. So you not only, you know, get a window into what the auction was like, you know, that you could go and potentially spot a famous person, but also you can see how the sale itself kind of gets woven into, you know, a new celebrity culture that's like emerging in this period, really. So, yeah.
Insane. Why were the final moments particularly dramatic?
Okay, so this really comes back to the Portland vase. So as I said, the Duchess has purchased the vase a year earlier in secret, and she's paid, like Sir William Hamilton before her, an extortionate amount of money for it. And So none of her family, it turns out, know that she's forked out this huge amount for, you know, something that's been dug out of the dirt in Italy. And so until the auction catalogue comes out in the days before the sale begins, no one knows that this is in her museum. And so there's a sort of panic amongst the family because they want to recoup some of the loss that the Duchess, you know, has created by buying this ridiculously expensive vase. And so the vase itself is the second to last lot of the whole 38 days. And there's a huge crowd that comes, and the Duke of Portland, so that's the Duchess's son, who's already been Prime Minister once at this point, so he's a really well-known public figure. He appears to bid on his mother's own vase in this really embarrassing moment, you know, where he's got to buy back his family jewels, essentially. And lots of other collectors appear, including Horace Walpole, who, you know, never has anything but snide remarks about the Duchess.
A hypocrite.
Absolutely. And they engage in this bidding war. And the Duke of Portland actually wins, and he buys it for a really crazy amount of money. And what's really fascinating is that from looking at different copies of the auction catalogue, where people often, you know, write in the margins who bought what they paid for it and things, we can piece together these sort of these exciting last few minutes. And it turns out that Josiah Wedgwood, the potter who you know, would go on to recreate the vase, was present on the final day. And so you can sort of imagine that he goes up to the Duke after the Duke's won the vase and says, "Can I borrow this? I really want to, you know, copy it." Because something like 3 or 4 days later, the vase appears on the back of a rickety old carriage in Staffordshire at Josiah Wedgwood's factory. And it stays there for 10 years while he tries to, you know, sort of experiment and work out exactly what it's made from and how the Romans have made such an amazing object and how he can copy it. So, you know, this last day of the sale has this incredible impact on art history in this country, and this one object in particular that we still hold as being important for, you know, sort of aesthetic and historical reasons.
I love it. I didn't know anything about her either, and I love her as well. And I kind of like, I'm annoyed for her that she was just perceived like this crazy woman who couldn't stop buying shoes, when actually yeah, it's got its faults, the collection, yeah, like you say, with interpretation, but as something of its time, it's invaluable.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the fact that it was used by all these people who are making really sort of new discoveries and new knowledge about the natural world, about the history and archaeology of this country. You know, her collection was really central to making these discoveries, and the fact that these objects are still in our national collections and that they still help us to understand those histories, if it wasn't for her, you know, collecting these objects and saving them for us, then we wouldn't necessarily have access to that data that they bring, you know, even today. So really, she's contributed hugely, you know, in some questionable ways as well. She was, you know, like I've said, very invested in these sort of colonial and racist narratives that we need to address and think about more and more. But she's undeniably, sort of invisibly, at the heart of our culture still.
It's crazy. So what are you going to do with your research?
So I finished my PhD a couple of years ago on the museum, and I'm writing up the book now. So sort of stay tuned.
Excellent. Well, I really look forward to it, because I think it's like part of our history that you're actually trying to give back, which is great. So thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about the Duchess of Portland.
Thank you for having me.
Join us tomorrow for a special edition of Pole Position. We'll be talking to Jack Fairweather about Witold Pilecki, because it is this week the anniversary of his death. He is of course the star of Jack's book, The Volunteer, which is a reference to his willing entrance into Auschwitz. And in the afternoon, we will be talking to Gilad Jaffe. Now, remember all those weeks ago when he came on and gave us a fabulous talk about biblical archaeology? Well, he's back, because in that show, he promised to come back and talk to us all about the archaeology of Jerusalem. And we had to do it. We couldn't wait any longer. So we're putting that out for you tomorrow. You can now nominate History Hack for an award. If you go to BritishPodcastAwards.com, you can nominate us for a Listener's Choice Award. We only found out about this today after some people had already cast some votes, and we were very excited. You have to do your vote by the 6th of July 2020, and they will announce the winner at the British Podcast Awards on Saturday the 11th of July 2020. So if you wouldn't mind, we'd really appreciate it. Don't forget that you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. All you need to do is go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. We'd like to keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus crisis, but we're poor, so we'd appreciate your help. There now follows a public service announcement.
I'm Horatio Hornblower, and I'm Archie Kennedy. The simplest gift you can give in these troubled times is to obey orders.
Indeed. The regulations are very clear in the matter. It is the duty of all of us to remain at anchor until the little people in the talking box signal you otherwise.
You don't want to end up getting flogged.
Good day to you.
Good day to you both.